Welcome to episode 615 of the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast, hosted by Sean Patrick, professional film critic, and Jeff Lasseter. I'm Bob Zero, the executive producer. And before we get to this week's episode, where they're going to talk about Ghostbusters and Roadhouse and a lot of other things, I want to remind you to go to our social media, Facebook, I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast, Twitter, Instagram, Critics Pod is the handle. Please subscribe to us there. Listen to us at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Alexa, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. We'll read your reviews on the air. What else do we got? YouTube. Listen over there. Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. Click on the little bell to be notified when a new episode drops. Patreon.com/CriticsPod is the best way to help support the podcast. Our T Public page is over at IHateCritics.net. That's also where you can find all of our websites. And I don't have it on me right now, but please check the show notes for Sean to read Sean's professional film critic movie reviews and get Jeff Lasseter's art. All right, let's get to the show. Welcome to the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast. I am professional film critic Sean Patrick. With me is Jeff.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Professional artist and all around just fucking genius.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I mean, you're a brilliant fucking artist. I'm going to talk you up whether you like it or not and make you very uncomfortable. And that's fine.
I appreciate it. I like being uncomfortable. It's literally my life.
Buy your art. That's what people need to do. They need to buy your art.
Yes. Yes. You should come and buy my art. Thinking about revamping my stuff. Etsy is kind of a cesspool lately, so I might. Looking into other things, a couple fellow creators have given me a couple ideas, so.
That's good. That's good.
We'll see. I just finished my first enamel pin design for another company that I'll put out there once it's in production. So.
Nice.
Yeah. It was spent the weekend in Chicago selling my stuff at Days of the Dead. With a bunch of cast members from Hellraiser and Nightbreed, which we should talk about someday because that's such a good movie.
I've talked about Nightbreed extensively on this show because
I haven't.
It's in my book.
Yeah. And then to cap it all off, Clive Barker was there doing his third appearance before he concentrates on writing some stuff. So yeah, I met a lot of cool people. I can post some photos if anybody's interested. But you can find all those on my Instagram, which is linked at jefflaster.com. So
your Nightbreed piece is exceptional.
Thank you. What's funny is I did that piece specifically to have Clive Barker sign it because Nightbreed meant so much to me as a kid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kid, I was 18 when it came out, but you know what I mean? I mean, now I consider that a kid. And I told him about, you know, I told him why I did it and whatever. And he goes, you know, he can't speak right now. Could speak a little bit on Friday, but, he spoke so much that it really took its toll. So he wasn't speaking, but he was like, you know, you did this. And I said, yeah, he goes, this is, you know, just he loved it. And I said, I'm more than happy to bring you one. And he just, you know, he shook his head yes and signed my piece. And I brought him one later and he was just very appreciative. That was super, super cool. So
that's amazing. That's a great moment.
So yeah, and then got to meet a lot of people from Hellraiser and Nightbreed, and you know, Ashley Lawrence was super, super sweet. You know, the whole cast was very, very nice about being there and talking to people. And, you know, I met Heather Langenkamp from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, nice.
She has two of my Nancy stickers on her little case that she brings with her for her photos and stuff.
That's awesome.
So I thought that was pretty cool. And then, you know, just got to, I met Nancy Kies, who was Nancy Loomis from Halloween, and she signed my Halloween print that I did. She was very nice and very like, you know, you did this when I told you. And again, it was just super cool. Stopped by my table a couple times. And yeah. So if you're ever having any, if you ever question about whether you want to attend one of these things, reach out. I can tell you all about them. They're so much fun. It is work for me.
Yeah.
But I try to make it fun. So, and yeah, that's Days of the Dead 2024 March. So still undecided if I'm going to go in November. A couple other things I have going on this year, but not too many. So I'm still trying to decide where to allocate my resources.
Sure. So, makes sense.
So, the more stuff you guys buy of mine, the more I can do these. Just saying.
Yes, exactly.
And I do have the Nightbreed and Hellraiser, and then I have my Gay Art the Clown prints that are going to go on Etsy probably by the time this comes out. So,
oh, nice.
And I also decided to print my Sleepaway Camp too with the superior Angela
Pamela
Springsteen, who I really wish would do conventions because she just seems so great. And then a couple other restocks and stuff. I almost sold out of my sexy Jar Jar at a horror convention, if that tells you anything.
That makes perfect sense to me because it's a horror piece.
And I did sell out of my twerking C-3PO, so I got to get those reprinted. And my my serial mom, Kathleen Turner, is this the cocksucker residence? Completely sold out of those. So I gotta get some prints once I get paid. So,
well, those are some things that people can look for when they go to your shop.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk about the new movies this week, because there's plenty to talk about. And we'll start with arguably, and I say arguably in the best possible way, arguably the best movie of the weekend, Late Night with the Devil, starring David Dastmalchian, directed brilliantly by Colin Cairns and Cameron Cairns. This is a very unique thing. It sets it up kind of as a piece of lost media, and lost media has kind of always been a fascination of mine. Ever since dating back to, you know, that story about the Florida newswoman who shot herself on TV.
Yes. Yeah. Rebecca Hall was in a movie about her.
Great, and great performance too. And I've been obsessed with that ever since. Not that I desperately want to see it, but just knowing that that happened and hearing stories about it made me fascinated with lost media. And so I've constantly like picking out these YouTube videos about lost media and hearing about all these various things that have happened on television that maybe you're lost forever. And so that this got me right off the bat. I was in because they tell the story right away that this is like a broadcast that is infamous and thought lost for years. And we present it to you now as it aired that night. And it's like, that's cool. That's such a great way to start. And then we get into the aesthetic, which is just a pitch perfect recreation of 1970s TV. It looks like it was videotaped in the 1970s, which is fantastic. And then, you know, David Dastmalchian is not a guy who is a typical looking guy, but when you think about talk show hosts, they're not the most handsome. They're usually they're there to make handsome people look even more handsome. He's perfect for this. He looks like a guy who should have been a character actor in the 70s. He should have been in Dog Day Afternoon. Like, that's the stuff monkey it is.
The fact that he plays a talk show host in this, he kind of has a Tom Snyder look. And I know that a lot of people don't know who that is, but he used to, there was the Tonight Show. And then after the Tonight Show, he hosted a show called Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Which was usually on after midnight. So
yeah,
he's got that vibe going on. Also a young Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
With that hair. So,
but he definitely seemed like a 1970s talk show host. They give him a backstory about how he left morning radio to challenge Johnny Carson. He rose up the ranks and even came close to beating Carson, and things happened and he started to go on a decline. His wife got sick, and he has her on the show in this desperate ploy for ratings, and that sets up the whole story about this infamous Halloween night broadcast in which he is trying to rescue his career, and all these things that happen from there. Absolutely brilliant. The way that Dust Malkin pulls this all together, he feels so authentic. He feels so right. And then he introduces this guy, Christu, who's the first guest of the night, Faisal Bazzi, who is a mentalist. And, he's talking to the crowd. He's doing the thing that you know mentalists to do. There's just kind of, they start off just a little touches of things going wrong and things getting weird. And then what happens to that character is fantastic. Yeah. they bring out this new character, Carmichael the Conjurer, who's a magician turned skeptic. And he's based on the amazing Randy, a real life 70s mm-hmm. celebrity and debunker, who is one of my all time heroes. Love that guy. Finally, they take on just this very almost straightforward style of possession horror when they bring out their final two guests, a little teenager and her doctor, who the teenager is supposedly possessed by a demon. And I love this movie, Jeff. I thought the aesthetic was brilliant. I thought the horror was fantastic. I thought the choices that they were making, the way they layered this story in, they gave you all this backstory, and then they're continuing to kind of drop in lore throughout, all while showing you this tape as it supposedly happened that night. It's such a clever idea, and it's such an exciting idea, and it's so well accomplished.
I very recently have had just a bunch of good movies in our rotation, and this is possibly the best this year. I don't know if it was just, it capped off Sunday for me. I got up at 5:30 just for no reason. I just couldn't sleep. And then, went to the convention and waited in line for Clive Barker and set up my table and had a good day. It was, good seeing everybody and meeting some new people. And then rush back to the Quad Cities to see this because when I'm at a convention, it's really hard to go do stuff like this. And I was thinking, please don't let this movie suck and just be good. And it was like the perfect capper to the perfect day that mm-hmm. just, I walked out of that theater in such a good mood because of this movie, because it was so good. And so something so different for a horror movie. Mm-hmm. But it was based in reality in that, this is the kind of stuff that these shows would do in the 70s. And David S. Malchin is just, he perfectly embodies the role, and he's got that veneer of talk show hosts throughout the first half of the movie, where it's just, it's, even though he suffered a great loss with his wife dying and, his ratings are starting to plummet a little bit, he still has that perfect veneer of, this is just who I am. And this is such a great idea, and we're going to have a great show. And and then when he lets it crack, like the cracks in the facade show through, you just like the briefest glimpses on his face. It's just so
real. Like little waves going across his face, like almost like an interrupted transmission. It's really great. And there's one moment where it's just one bead of sweat. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so good. It's so good.
Yeah. All the performances were so real for me.
Yeah.
It just, when Carmichael is being a blowhard and, And he's just, he doesn't quite expose the way that mentalists come in and say, you know, oh, I'm getting this and I'm getting that. And then somebody shouts it out and they're like, you know, I could say to you, knowing that your mom's name began with an S,
mm-hmm.
but even if I didn't, that I'd be like, you know, I'm getting a name and it starts with an M. No, that's not it. And then, you know, you might say, is it an S? But he never quite does that, but he starts to hint around at it.
Right.
And I got the distinct impression that if he let all his secrets go, that he wouldn't have anything to do either. So he seemed to be like straddling that fence. And
I liked that Ian Bliss is the actor who plays Carmichael. And I thought the movie was surprisingly fair to him, as much as they needed him to be sort of not a villain, but certainly a fly in the ointment. And many people could take this as kind of a takedown of that debunker character, but I thought they were really fair to him, especially in the sequence where he hypnotizes the co-host. I thought that, mm-hmm. wow, what a great sequence.
Yeah.
It was so great the way they did that. And then they followed that up brilliantly too. It's so good. Everything is these intricate puzzle pieces. There's a moment early on where Christy, who again, that guy does a fantastic job, mm-hmm. Just being kind of in over his head, but also, you know, trying so desperately hard to pull everything off with a sort of confidence. I loved that. I loved the sort of Striver quality to him. Faiz al-Bazi, he's really terrific. But they go out to the crowd and they find a guy and he's sitting behind another guy who's in a costume. And that costume is like something out of a fucking Ari Aster movie. And I'm like, fuck yeah, dude.
Yep.
That's there for a reason. I love this.
Well, and see, that's, yeah, I'm like, is that the devil there? You know, I mean, is it actually somebody who's just in costume, or is it, mm-hmm. somebody... Is it like a manifestation or something?
It's just the first indication that there's something off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so good. It's such a great seed to plant, to begin the portion where you're going to take this off the rails. When you find out what happened to Christu, is another just, it's like turning up the electricity in the room for a moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the movie is just so good at doing that. And, you know, take it down a little bit. Like, again, that sequence with Carmichael trying to debunk the hypnosis, like, that took it down for a moment. And then you're like, mm-hmm. There's kind of a couple times where it doesn't feel like there might be something supernatural going on. We might just be manipulated by television. And the movie's very open to that idea. And you have to see the movie yourself to find out for sure. It's all just so very, very good.
One of the things too, what you just said about, you know, is this all being manipulated? I kind of, the guy that Christu starts talking to seemed like an audience plant to me.
Mm.
And decide, you know, he was like, I'm going to be the audience plant and I'm going to, he gets up and he just starts telling jokes. So that's what made me think he was an audience plant, and that, okay, maybe this is just, you know, they did this for ratings or something, but they, you know, it's not really like the devil or something like that.
Yeah.
So.
It gets kind of a weirdly genial start.
Yeah. And again, that's the 70s and, you know, 70s and early 80s on these kind of shows. So yeah, everybody's genial and happy. And
you could see this on an episode of Merv Griffin in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Douglas or any of that, you know. Definitely would do shows like this that were just kind of weird and off and unique and different. And everybody's trying to find a way to get around Carson, who's got the, mm-hmm. The lockdown on all the big name celebrities. Yeah. And a unique way to appeal. And that certainly is one of those unique ways.
I did like how, they did all the little tropes that, Carson used to do, where they would do skits and they the lady from the San Diego Zoo on,
yeah,
escaping me, with the, you know, with the strange and interesting animals, and then mm-hmm. they turn that all on the head, on their head at the climax.
Yeah.
And left you wondering what actually happened. How do we explain, you know, is there an explanation for any of this, or is it just, you know, like, is he having a breakdown even?
Yeah.
You know, because he did lose his wife, his ratings are tanking, he's probably going to lose his show, and is all this stuff happening, or is he just having a breakdown about it?
Right. And then of course there's those little seeds planted about Redwood Forest in California. Oh, and
taking it over, whatever the is.
Yeah. The little seeds, just little seeds planted here and there to just continue to throw you off and change mm-hmm. the story. Change the story around. It's just, I love this movie.
I did too. It was, we're going to talk about another one that I absolutely loved as well, but I, not Ghostbusters, I didn't see that. but this was, if I had to put those two like head to head, this was probably my favorite, just based on growing up in the 70s and 80s and seeing all this stuff mm-hmm. and then how good they got it.
They nailed it. They absolutely nailed it. And it's not even just the storytelling, it's the aesthetic of it. It's just
mm-hmm.
so good. The direction is so smart and so it's just so well crafted. The sound, the light, the everything, the way the manipulation of the videotape is so good. That's the thing that great directors do. And we've got a pair of debuting directors here in this movie, and of course the other movie we're going to talk about has a first-time director as well, and it's like this is like a bounty right now with these new directors coming along and just blowing us away,
you know. And it has been a really good year for horror movies and horror adjacent movies, so I mean, but you know, is this week the peak? Because I
wonder. Ooh. I mean, I do wonder, because yeah. I mean, it's, you get two movies like this on the same weekend. I hope they didn't. I hope they didn't take away from each other in terms of audiences.
Did you see that on? They advertised that on Sunday, this movie, Late Night with the Devil, made $666,666.
I heard that.
I mean, I know they do that shit for like, you know, publicity, and I'm sure that's not what it was, but I just thought that was hilarious that they, you know, let's do that, because one of our other movies had a really good advertising campaign that came out of the weekend too. So,
Well, let's talk about the other great movie this weekend, Immaculate, starring Sidney Sweeney, and directed by, again, another first time director, Michael Mahan. This movie is about a nun who gets a job she goes to go to a convent in Italy after her convent shuts down in Detroit, Michigan. And she's invited there to be at this convent, which is essentially a hospice for elderly nuns, which is, you know, quite a calling for a nun to go to. And so obviously she would be very interested in doing that. And she goes there with that plan to minister to nuns who are heading out of this earth into the next life. And her job takes an immediate turn when she arrives there and she falls ill and finds out that she is pregnant. She has never had sex with a man, and this is thus termed a virgin birth. And thus her job then becomes mother to the next savior. And what I love about Sydney Sweeney's performance is that she's not this naive waif, but she's also not somebody who's very worldly. So she's fully instinctual, this character. She just has to be acting upon an instinct to protect herself. She knows something's wrong, and the movie does well to seed in why she would think that, why she would be suspicious, but also she's a smart character who's very resourceful and instinctual. And that's a really great kind of a turn of a character, because we don't often see characters like that. Either they're naive, waifish, and, you know, at the mercy of everyone around them, or you know, they're so worldly and cynical that, you know, they're an entirely different kind of character. So mm-hmm. I thought it's rare to see this kind of twist on a character like this, especially in a movie that, again, is also set somewhere that is not necessarily innovative. We've seen a lot of religious horror movies over the years. So they've got to take those tropes and elevate them. And I think this movie does that by being so incredibly detailed in every aspect, from sound to music to pacing. This is a movie where the director really had a good eye and ear to make this happen, because he's got to elevate this material above the things that we expect of a religious horror movie. And I thought he did that. And especially I thought the sound design on this movie was spectacular. The way that the sound is used in this movie to place the horror in your mind. So you're like watching this movie through your fingers, but you're not getting away from it because the sound is so good. You don't even need the visual to be terrified by this movie. And that is just, I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this was a trip, because it kind of, everything you expect that's going to happen is not what it's about. I mean, you go into a religious horror movie, and as someone who doesn't believe, it's like, okay, you know, it's another supernatural thing, and then it's not, but it might be. I really struggled to find anything about this to criticize,
mm-hmm.
because I'm like, okay, it's just another religious horror movie. And then I got about halfway through, and I'm like, there is literally nothing that I can, there's nothing that I dislike about this movie. It's smart. It doesn't shy away from anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, from the first scene to the last scene.
Oh yeah.
We did have Chekhov's nun in the first scene that I was assuming was going to pop up somewhere else, you know. But she didn't.
I thought that opening sequence was exceptional. Part of what I love about this movie is that it grabbed me instantly. And again, mm-hmm. it was the sound design, because you ever notice how when you're home and like you have other people in your house and you don't want to wake anybody up and it's dark and you don't want to make any noise, suddenly everything about your house is louder.
Yeah,
this is a universal experience that everybody has had. And this movie is so smart in the way it uses its sound. It seems to turn up the sound of whether it's keys or a drawer or just a loose floorboard. Everything just seems a little too loud. And I loved that.
Yeah, the first scene when the unnamed nun is she's trying to get the keys from Mother Superior. It's like, and they are so loud. It was like opening one of those, you know, like when you go to the grocery store and they make their own cinnamon buns or whatever. It's like opening one of those things in the middle of the night. So loud. The actual plot and what this movie is about, and the filmmaker said they didn't. It is not made with a message necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but the whole time, I just kept thinking she's just completely constantly being manipulated by dudes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, she is completely at the mercy of men throughout the movie and doesn't like that. And she, you know, she's bound and determined that she's going to be her own person. And I feel like, you know, her fervent belief that she was saved for something kind of made her think, well, I guess this is what I was saved for. And then she realizes what's actually going on. She's like, I feel like that's the moment where she's like, you know what? I don't believe any of this. This has all been a joke to me. When she finds the dossier on her and, you know, that says basically kind of reiterates the fact that she thinks that she was saved for a greater purpose. And she's like, she just gets this look on her face. Like, my only purpose now is to live my life for myself as opposed to God, who I don't even know if she believes in by the end of the movie. The scene where she sees her one ally being tortured was kind of the turning point for me too. I felt her. She finally said, oh, this is not right. And, you know, what are they going to do to me if I don't do what they say? So.
Yeah. And, you know, we're leading up to the final act of this movie is so good. It picks up the pace in such a perfect way, because at that point, you know, it's reached a point at going into the third act where where can this possibly fucking go? And then they found that next deer, where they make it into this endless chase. And then it's all leading up to this final moment that is just spectacular. They put it right there in your brain the whole time. And I loved that so much, how the horror was so much greater in what I was thinking was happening and what it was happening to. I don't want to give it away, but the horror just thinking of what that was greater than the need to see it. And I loved that. Just so good.
When I first saw the ending, and I'm not going to give it away, I'm going to try to speak as obliquely as I can about it. Mm-hmm. You know, she is pregnant, and you believe that this is an immaculate conception and that it might be the savior, or could it be, you know, could they all be trying to bring about the birth of the Antichrist, like in Rosemary's Baby?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you find out what's kind of like the real life part of this, it's just like, oh. And then, you know, you see different things. I really try to, it's so great, but I kind of have to like talk myself through it. You know, was this one of those things, or was that, you know, the actual savior? Is it actually the Antichrist? You know, what
doesn't matter? It doesn't matter. Yeah.
It totally doesn't. But it's those scenes where she is, when she comes out of a tunnel, we'll just say that, into the light at one point. And her backstory, she was trapped under the ice and somehow got out. They don't say if she was saved or she broke the ice or whatever, but that, you know, she alludes to that being like the birth of her faith. And it's one point she comes out of these catacombs into the light, and it's very hard for her to get out. And it's almost again like she's being birthed before she gives birth. And when, you know, she does this whole scream thing where it's a sustained thing that was deeply unsettling to a lot of the people that were in the theater with me. Myself kind of included. It was the complete opposite of Mia Goth at the end of Pearl, where she's just like smiling to the camera silently.
Yeah. This
is Sydney Sweeney is screaming into the camera like uncontrollably, and for so long that she starts to like snot comes out of her mouth. It's just, ugh. Yeah. And And then that, and that's not even the end, you know, that's not like, that's not the end. And then the end just hits you and you're just like, oh my God. And again, this is one of those movies like Love Lies Bleeding, where I talked about last week, where I saw this movie and then I had to go directly to work.
Yeah.
So that's all I thought about at work yesterday was just, what did I watch? Holy shit. Right? And I love,
yeah.
And again, I am not a believer, and you know, we've talked about that several times. That's why I don't generally love religious horror, and I don't find it really that scary. This is fucking scary about the stuff that like she went through. And she's a survivor in so many different ways. You know, she's smart. Like you said, she figures out a way to escape. And if it wasn't for fucking weird ass blood obsessed nuns, she would have gotten away. that was one of the most disturbing scenes in the
movie. So good. Yeah.
There's a scene with a nun burying her face in blood drenched sheets. And it's just like, So
I would overcome with religious fervor, and a great, great performance by that actress as well in that moment too.
Yeah.
So deeply committed to that. The whole thing just, it just works. It's just incredibly well directed. This director had just an eye for every single detail. On top of just elevating this, you know, relatively overwrought genre of religious horror, and just finding a way to press that up a little bit and change it. Like that's what you got to do. Like in this day and age, we've seen so many movies, and they've made so many movies that it's hard to escape genre and trope. So if you're going to do a genre or trope, you have to find a way to elevate it. And he certainly did. With the incredible work of the team that he put together to create the sound, to create the music, the settings. The set is superb. I mean, it looks like you feel like you can smell the old wood in that building. Mm-hmm. Like it's phenomenal. It's just so good.
You know, I can't remember. I know they filmed some of like the, you know, classic Italian horrors there. But I can't remember which ones. Somebody said something the other day about it, and I just like, oh, I got to look at that now, because the location and the setting and the it's all practical, and it's, you know, it's not set; it's all filmed there, and it just like, holy shit!
I hope a lot of people go see this. I do. I really want this to be a huge hit.
Do you remember when we talked about Consecration last year with Jenna Malone?
Oh, yeah, that wasn't very good.
It was not very good. But I feel like if it had been half as good as this, I would have 100% given that a recommend. It's just, I kept thinking, like, this is what Consecration wanted to be, except I couldn't think of the name while I was watching Immaculate.
Yeah.
I was like, this is what that Jenna Malone nun movie wanted to be. But yeah, this was,
I guess if I had one thing, I kind of wanted to know more about the math nuns, the ones with the red faces. Yeah. I kind of wanted to know what that was about, but it's not a big thing. I don't need a payoff for that because again, there's no room in that third act for that anyway. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind that not getting resolved because the ending is such a great ending. I don't want to change a moment of that scene from the fire to the catacombs. I don't want to change a thing.
Exactly. Yeah. That fire, I was just, oh, you've got, you so know, good. Oh yeah.
Yeah. We're going to sit here and just talk about this movie for the rest of the night. So
yeah, I'm just going to keep saying, oh,
all right, we'll take it down a notch and talk about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Ghostbusters, the sequel, the latest sequel with all the cast and Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon and McKenna Grace and all them. It's good. It's solid. It's good enough. I liked it. I know a lot of people didn't. That's fine. I didn't hate it. It's not, there's issues with it. Like I got a problem with this one. There's like one plot twist that makes no sense. So I'm going to just complain about it for a moment.
Okay.
So Ray, Dan Aykroyd, you know, he's a well-established Ghostbuster. He's up there in years, obviously, but he's, you know, he's still a Ghostbuster. He's still alive, still doing his thing. He goes and gets involved, and he takes McKenna Grace and this kid podcast to this library where they talk to Patton Oswalt, who's an expert in ancient languages, and this lets loose this demon character. And this demon character gets into a lion and attacks Ray, and he has to be saved by McKenna Grace's character, and they blow up the lion, and it's this famous library lion and whatnot. And, like, characters start getting mad at Ray for taking the kids to this situation. It's like, what are you talking about? These are, first of all, they've just battled ghosts in the last movie, these kids, and saved the world. Secondly, a lion was about to eat Ray, so they had to blow it up. There wasn't an option here. Everybody saw this. Witnesses saw this. And then they put this argument against what, you know, Ray did in this situation, which is essentially almost get eaten by a demon-possessed cement lion, in the voice of Ernie Hudson's character, who's like, Ernie Hudson, he's a Ghostbuster. He knows that this has happened before. Like, why would he be the one to get mad at Ray for fighting ghosts? They literally still do that together. Like, why would you put that in his mouth? He tells Ray that, like, you shouldn't be doing this anymore. And it's like, dude, you're still doing it. You just built a brand new ghost containment and are funding the entire new Ghostbusters. What are you talking about telling Ray not to do it anymore? What? That's so stupid. It's so stupid. Yeah. And the McKenna Crazy's character, like, gets in trouble for this. She saved his life from a raging demonic cement lion, and she gets in trouble for this. And it's like this dumb, needless roadblock that doesn't belong in the movie.
That's weird.
That's sad. I mean, everything, it's still pretty funny, and you know, it still pretty much works. You know, everybody shows up and does their thing and is funny. I really enjoyed the Camille Nanjiani's in the movie, and I really enjoy how they use him. He's kind of the Rick Moranis of the movie, which I liked. Kind of funny in that way. But I like enough of this movie to say go see it. At the same time, there's got a lot of flaws, but I don't mind it.
Do they bring back the ghost of Spengler again?
No, he's not in this one.
Okay.
No, he evaporated into ghostly material in the last movie. So
I know, you just never know, you know.
You think he's back one moment, which she's in the park playing chess by herself at night, and she sets up her chessboard and she's playing chess, and then the pieces start to move, and then they introduce a new character, this new ghost. Mm. And I love that there's a concept they introduce here that ghosts have, like, things that bind them to the earth. Like, it's not a new concept. It's kind of something they've talked about before, but they kind of give it a little new life here where they have this machine that they invented that can separate ghost matter from, you know, regular everyday things that hold them in place. And yeah. The idea that if you give up this thing that means so much to you as a ghost, that you can ascend to heaven. I liked that idea. And I thought that idea played out pretty well in the movie.
Oh, okay.
So there are good ideas here. There are good jokes. Paul Rudd's funny. it's good to know that the Ghostbusters song is canon. Like, it's something that happened in the universe of this movie. So I like that. It made me happy. All right. What didn't make me happy is the worst movie of the year so far. Fucking Roadhouse. Fucking mad about it, man.
Uh-huh.
I fucking love Roadhouse. We'll get to it, but this is not Roadhouse. I don't know what this is. Roadhouse with Jake Gyllenhaal, directed by Doug Liman, has Gyllenhaal playing Dalton, a former MMA fighter who lost his career when he nearly killed a guy in the ring. Now he just kind of fights in bars occasionally, and he goes into this bar where Post Malone is, like, six guys in. Like, Post Malone is this guy who's just, he's already fought six guys and beaten them. Then in what this Dalton character is this well-known MMA fighter, and he wants to fight next, and Post Malone's like, fuck that, I've already been through six fights tonight. Fuck this, I'm not fighting this fucker. And he walks off. And it's like, this is how you're introducing your heroic character? he's going to fight a guy who's already busted up, bleeding him, and fought six guys. That's how you're going to introduce him? This is not how you introduce a hero. You introduce a hero by having him in a bar, doing his, drinking coffee in a blazer with feathered hair, being a Zen bouncer. That's how you introduce your heroic character. I'm worked up.
Clearly.
The character of Frankie, who is the who takes the place of the roadhouse owner in this one, happens to see Dalton show up and intimidate everybody into just giving him the money, and he doesn't even have to fight. And she decides that he's the guy that she wants to be her new head bouncer at her roadhouse in the Florida Keys. He takes the job after nearly killing himself and goes down there and ends up fighting drug dealers or something. Billy Magnuson is the bad guy, and he's just awful. What a shitty bad guy. Conor McGregor is supposedly the big bad guy, the MMA fighter. And I'll give him this, Jeff, like his introduction to the movie. He's just naked, walking through the streets of Italy, punching people to the point where things explode. That's Roadhouse to me. That's kind of a Roadhouse thing. I like that. But beyond that, though, he's a terrible actor, and he's not very good in this movie, because nobody is good in this movie. And we're talking about way too much talent to be applied to a Roadhouse movie. We're talking about, like, Jessica Williams. We're talking about Jake Gyllenhaal, Doug Liman. What are you guys doing? This is Roadhouse we're talking about. You guys are way too talented for Roadhouse. Roadhouse is sleazy and sweaty and gross and fucking hilarious. This is not Roadhouse. I don't know what this is.
Well, whatever it is, it wasn't for me. It just kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And I'm like, I checked out. I literally just checked out. I'm like, all right, full disclosure, and I know you're going to like end the show, but I was not a huge fan of the original. Just not, you know, just was not, again, not my kind of movie.
Maybe you just don't understand the magic of it yet.
Oh, I'm sure that's what it was.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
But there were a couple moments that I thought were kind of okay. But I honestly, halfway through, I just checked out. I'm like, you know what? I don't care. I don't care about anybody in this movie. I get that, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal is supposed to be, you know, he's supposed to like have his crisis of conscience, whatever. But no, it was terrible.
It's awful. And then, you know, the romance character of he falls in with this doctor played by Daniela Melchior, who's way too old for, first of all. I know it's only like a 13 year age difference. It still is like, it felt wrong to me, but anyway, they also have the chemistry of like cousins who aren't quite sure where they land on the family tree, like that kind of sexual chemistry. they just don't spark at all. And especially whatever you say about the original Roadhouse, fucking Patrick Swayze and Kelly Lynch, gorgeous together. That is like I'm glad they were a real life couple, because they needed to populate the world. Those two were beautiful together. And they had amazing sexual chemistry in that movie, whereas this movie, like, again, I wouldn't even buy these two as friends.
Yeah,
so bad. But everything about this movie is bad. Like, this is one of the worst of the year. I don't understand the praise it's getting. I don't understand anybody who likes this movie. what did you see? What could you have possibly seen in this movie? I don't understand. It's awful. Whereas, and so do you remember the movie Almost Famous?
Yeah.
So there's this brilliant scene early on in Almost Famous where they introduce Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Bangs, and this great rant about the Doors. He sees a Doors record and he just launches into this just this beautiful thing that he says, where it's like, I'm trying to recall it now from my head. He says, The Doors, Jim Morrison, he's a drunken buffoon posing as a poet. Give me the Guess Who. They've got the courage to be drunken buffoons, and that makes them poetic. That, to me, is the perfect illustration of the difference between this Roadhouse and the original, because the original is just a drunken buffoon. And in there, there's the poetry of a great bad movie. Because Roadhouse doesn't understand just how bad a movie that it is. And there is magic in that. It's like The Room, where, you know, Tommy Wiseau takes all the talent that he doesn't have and applies it to making a motion picture that he feels is the true expression of his heart. And it's so poignant to watch somebody do something so badly with their whole heart. That is what is happening in Roadhouse with Rowdy Harrington and Patrick Swayze just applying the talent that they don't have to try and create something, you know, so beautiful, and it's so bad and so sleazy and so ugly. It's just this terrible, terrible child that they've created. And to me, I just love it so much because of that. I love the poignance of a great bad movie, and that's what Dirty Dad Roadhouse is. Dirty Dad is a great movie. Roadhouse is a terrible film, but it doesn't know how bad it is, and that makes it brilliant.
Okay. I was like, for me, it was the one of those movies that when it came out, I was just, it was just not for me. I mean, it was just not what I was into at the time. So I guess I missed it. You know, I missed the Overton window for Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze. I didn't care that much about him until I saw Tu Wong Fu, if we're going to be perfectly honest. When I as an adult, I can understand why it's popular and what people would see in it. It did not survive the sleep test because I did fall asleep towards the end. Towards the very end, you know, they were all right. They were kind of starting to wrap things up a little bit. And
Did you get to see the throat rip?
Did see that. Yes.
Good. Again, because there's not a single throat ripped in the new Roadhouse. Not one throat gets ripped.
And there really should have been.
I mean, he like breaks the guy's trachea. Like, just rip the throat. Rip the throat.
Yeah.
You're right there. Your hand is right there.
I can only imagine that that's just something that Jake Gyllenhaal didn't want to do. You know, where he was like, we can't make him, make him that bad.
Can't make him directly responsible for a death.
Yeah. I will say, however, that I did like the scene in the new one where he just kind of, the guy just starts getting eaten by an alligator. I was like, the one high point for me was that.
Yeah.
But.
And the original, I mean, so there was this point in my life where, like, or in my teenage years where I got to see Roadhouse based off of my sister loves Patrick Swayze. She loved Dirty Dancing. She, you know, just loved him. But we reached that age where we were finally able to kind of see movies and actually see movies as being bad for the first time. And that's when Roadhouse hit HBO and started being on all the time. And so we're watching Roadhouse, and there's this scene early on in Roadhouse where one of the bad guy bouncers who's about to be fired, he's taken a woman into the back room and he is ramming her from behind. And we see this just this ugly, gross, disgusting man just ramming this woman from behind in a bar in the back room. And he says to her, one of the greatest lines in cinema history, "I'm going to make you my regular Saturday night thing." And we lost our minds. It was the funniest thing. We had the combination of just redneck horrors in front of us. It looked like something that could happen in a bar down the street from us. And it just made us laugh so hard that Roadhouse just transcended at that moment. On top of which, you've just got Patrick Swayze delivering this very serious, very, you know, focused Zen bouncer performance that is totally at odds with the Z movie drive-in film that he's in. It's very, very funny. Ben Gazzara is so sleazy. He just drips, drenched in sleaze. And I just adore him for that. Then you've got Sam Elliott, who just is the only person who knows what movie he's in. He's not taking any of this seriously. He's just there to look cool and punch people. I loved it. I can't stop loving Roadhouse.
Okay, so Roadhouse is your 9 to 5.
I guess so. I mean, if you consider 9 to 5 to be a bad movie that
well,
you love.
No, but it's a movie that you love that I just cannot.
Perhaps. I love it for being bad because I know it's a bad movie. I love the fact that it's bad. It's bad. It's so bad. It's good. It's so bad. It transcends. Okay. Being bad.
Okay.
Yeah, there's this great Family Guy bit where it's one of the greatest bits in Family Guy history. Peter Griffin is just driving his car and he's just watched Roadhouse. So now instead of using his hands, he just kicks the wheel and just says Roadhouse. Roadhouse. It's so stupid, but it's so fucking funny because it's like, yeah, everything in Roadhouse is just answered by kicking.
Yeah, well, okay, that's a good point.
There's no problem that can't be solved with kicking. Jeff, I'm not looking forward to next week.
What's next week?
It's Godzilla and Kong.
Oh.
Like, we just got a really good Godzilla movie. Can't we let that breathe for a little while?
Yeah. Okay, love Kong Skull Island. Love Godzilla Minus One.
That is not part of this franchise.
No, I know. Trust me, I'm well aware. This does look like hot trash.
The baby King Kong is, oh, God. It's like the seventh season of a sitcom where you're like, just toss in another cute kid to keep people interested. Now King Kong's a dad. Don't you want to see King Kong be a dad? No, I don't want to see King Kong be a dad.
Absolutely fucking not. I do not.
Have him climb a building again or something. I don't know. Or just don't make another Kong movie. I don't know. I would much rather watch a rubber-suited Godzilla versus a fursuit ape guy in Japan on tiny sets than watch this.
Agreed.
I'll try and be as fair to it as possible, but I'm not excited. I've got one movie I am excited about next week that I've actually already seen, and I won't say too much about it, but I was surprised by the new Liam Neeson movie In the Land of Saints and Sinners. It's better than you might expect, so there's that. I don't know if we're actually getting Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey 2. I know it's going to play Thursday night for sure, but I don't know if it's actually like opening. Or if it's just one of those.
It's playing Thursday night. I guess I'll call off work to go see it. No, I'm kidding. God, I couldn't even get through the first one. I thought, okay, it's hilarious. Every time something goes into the public domain, they make a horror movie of it, and it's funny. And then I tried to watch it.
Ugh.
Yikes.
Yeah, not good. Sean Penn has a new movie called Asphalt City that is also coming out this weekend that I'm going to watch tomorrow. So all of that coming next week. It's going to be a big letdown from this week, that's for sure, where we got two best of the year candidate movies.
Yeah.
Definitely going to be a step down.
I can't think of course, like this past weekend couldn't have been Kong. Right. Where I would have said, you know what? I'm sorry. I'm going to skip that because it's not worth driving, 90 miles an hour to get home in time to see it before I pass out. Mm-hmm. Whereas Late Night with the Devil was. I wish that next week was these, like, even if it was Ghostbusters next weekend, it's like.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, little flick chart.
Yeah, I can do that.
All right, we've got The Wicker Man 2006 versus Stealing Harvard with Tom Green and Jason Lee.
The Wicker Man.
Yeah, just for the bees. Not the bees!
The bees! Not the bees!
Annabelle Creation or Hitchcock's Saboteur, 1942.
Saboteur. Although, and the Annabelle Creation is probably the best of the Annabelle movies.
Just saying. Low bar.
I know. Fully aware.
Let's see here. What we got? What we got? Encanto or The Mission, 1986?
The Mission.
Yeah. Nothing against Encanto. It's fine.
It's fine.
Footloose, 2011, or Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince?
Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah. Transformers: Age of Extinction or The Squid and the Whale? Can you give me two more different movies?
The Squid and the Whale, please.
Let's see. Staying with the Jesse Eisenberg theme, The Social Network or 12 Years a Slave?
The Social Network, because I cannot watch 12 Years a Slave again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did I ever tell you I sold Jesse Eisenberg a home projector when I worked at Best Buy in New York City? Yes, I did.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
He's very nice, by the way. He's like, he's one of the most chill guys. And his manager came in first and he's like, hey, I'm going to bring somebody in, you know, whatever. And then talk to me first. And he's like, okay, you seem decent enough. He just, you know, he just wants to shop. And I said, okay, cool. And then we had this guy named Hans who worked there who, oh my God. Whoa. Oh my God. And ran and like bought a DVD to have him sign. And I was like,
dude,
I said, and I apologize. He goes, it's fine. I think, is he slow? And I was like, I said, no, he's just an idiot.
All right. The Killer 2023 or Dumb and Dumber 2?
Oh, did we watch The Killer?
I did. With David Fincher?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. There's so many names like, yeah. Oh, totally that. Yeah.
Have you seen God Bless America, Bobcat Goldthwait's movie?
I have not yet.
It's worth it. It's worth it. 2011. It was that one or Hairspray 1988. So we'll skip God Bless America because only I've seen it. And we'll see if we can get an actual movie here. cartoon short. All right. Belle du Jour 1967 or Hairspray 1988.
I did not see Belle du Jour yet.
Belle du Jour is amazing.
But I love Hairspray. I love John Waters. I'm so happy he's making another movie.
He is. Oh, wow.
Yeah. He's adapting his novel Liar Mouth.
Hmm.
And I'll let you read the synopsis. It's really funny. Aubrey Plaza is going to play the lead.
Oh, nice.
If there was ever somebody who should be cast in a John Waters movie, it is Aubrey Plaza.
It is kind of perfect. All right. Poltergeist or Stalker 1979?
Poltergeist.
Stalker for me.
Poltergeist.
I don't love Poltergeist. Coin flip goes to Stalker.
Sure.
All right. Outsiders or Weird, the Al Yankovic story?
I have not seen Weird yet.
Oh, it's really good.
Is it?
Highly recommend.
Okay, you can pick that if you like. I am sure that.
All right. Red 2 or Sherlock Holmes 2?
Yeah. Lotomy? Red 2.
Fishing with Gandhi?
Well, I'll just say Red 2 because I am not a Guy Ritchie fan in general.
Mm. Red 2 wins.
He's Guy Ritchie is like Matthew Vaughn and a lot of tequila.
I think they're about equal. I don't know. I don't mind. Yeah. I don't really mind either of them. They're not great all the time. They're not bad all the time, as far as I'm concerned. Fast Five or Surf Ninjas? They're not the same movie. Shut up.
Oh my God, Fast Five, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, Jesse Eisenberg again. What do you know? The algorithm listens. Now You See Me or Catwoman?
Can I say Catwoman? Because I think it's one of those movies that is so bad it's good, and it's kind of a guilty pleasure. So I'm going to say Catwoman.
Oh my God, no! I said no. Now You See. Oh my, wow. Yeah, I couldn't in good conscience. No. Hey, he was so nice to you. Why would you do that?
Catwoman has great memories for me.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, or Poseidon 2006?
I don't like either one of them.
they're both kind of... Poseidon is genuinely bad. I think at least Robin Hood kind of has moments.
Yeah, I guess we can pick Robin Hood. It had better toys.
It's got the Bryan Adams song.
Which is not a good thing as far as I'm concerned. Fucking hate Bryan Adams. Oh my God.
Fighting with My Family or Beauty and the Beast 2017 live action?
Fighting with My Family.
Heck of a good movie, isn't it?
Yeah, Florence Pugh, like, always going to pick her.
Soap Dish or Body Heat?
Oh, oh my God. Those are both movies I love because they're so, like, terrible. Okay,
I got Body Heat. Dish. Oh,
I'm
wow.
Pick Soap Dish because that's a movie that I could just have on in the background. It's like drop dead gorgeous. I can turn it on at any time and I can I don't have to pay attention to it and it can always just be there. Whereas Body Heat, I have to sit down and watch.
Hmm.
So I'm picking something freaking Body Heat.
Body Heat wins. All right. Let's wrap it up. What do you say?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Good night, Jesse Eisenberg. Thank you for all you've done for the world.
Night, Jess.